Chapter 9. Robin ran up the clanging metal stairs in the same low heels that she had worn the previous day. 24 hours ago, unable to dislodge the word gumshoe from her mind, she had selected her frumpiest footwear for a day's walking. Today, excited by what she had achieved in the old black shoes, they had taken on the glamour of Cinderella's glass slippers. Hardly able to wait to tell Strike everything she had found out, she had almost run to Denmark Street through the sunlit rubble. She was confident that any lingering awkwardness after Strike's drunken escapades of 2 nights previously would be utterly eclipsed by their mutual excitement about her dazzling solo discoveries of the previous day. But when she reached the second landing, she pulled up short. For the third time, the glass door was locked, and the office beyond it unlit and silent. She let herself in and made a swift survey of the evidence. The door to the inner office stood open. Strike's camp bed was folded neatly away. There was no sign of an evening meal in the bin. The computer monitor was dark, the kettle cold. Robin was forced to conclude that Strike had not, as she phrased it to herself, spent the night at home. She hung up her coat, then took from her handbag a small notebook, turned on the computer, and after a few minutes' hopeful but fruitless wait, began to type up a précis of what she had found out the day before. She had barely slept for the excitement of telling Strike everything in person. Typing it all out was a bitter anticlimax. Where was he? As her fingers flew over the keyboard, an answer she did not much like presented itself for her consideration. Devastated as he had been at the news of his ex's engagement, was it not likely that he had gone to beg her not to marry this other man? Hadn't he shouted to the whole of Charing Cross Road that Charlotte did not love Jago Ross? Perhaps, after all, it was true. Perhaps Charlotte had thrown herself into Strike's arms, and they were now reconciled, lying asleep, entwined, in the house or flat from which she had been ejected 4 weeks ago. Robin remembered Lucy's oblique inquiries and insinuations about Charlotte, and suspected that any such reunion would not bode well for her job security. Not that it matters, she reminded herself, typing furiously and with uncharacteristic inaccuracy. You're leaving in a week's time. The reflection made her feel even more agitated. Alternatively, of course, Strike had gone to Charlotte and she had turned him away. In that case, the matter of his current whereabouts became a matter of more pressing, less personal concern. What if he had gone out, unchecked and unprotected, hell-bent on intoxication again? Robin's busy fingers slowed and stopped mid-sentence. She swiveled on her computer chair to look at the silent office telephone. She might well be the only person who knew that Cormoran Strike was not where he was supposed to be. Perhaps she ought to call him on his mobile. And if he did not pick up, how many hours ought she to let elapse before contacting the police? The idea of ringing Matthew at his office and asking his advice came to her, only to be swatted away. She and Matthew had rowed when Robin arrived home very late, after walking a drunken Strike back to the office from the Tottenham. Matthew had told her yet again that she was naive, impressionable, and a sucker for a hard luck story, that Strike was after a secretary on the cheap and using emotional blackmail to achieve his ends, that there was probably no Charlotte at all, that it was all an extravagant ploy to engage Robin's sympathy and services. Then Robin had lost her temper and told Matthew that if anybody was blackmailing her, it was he, with his constant harping on the money she ought to be bringing in and his insinuation that she was not pulling her weight. Hadn't he noticed that she was enjoying working for Strike? Hadn't it crossed his insensitive, obtuse accountant's mind that she might be dreading the tedious bloody job in human resources? Matthew had been aghast, and then, though reserving the right to deplore Strike's behaviour, apologetic. But Robin, usually conciliatory and amiable, had remained aloof and angry. The truce effected the following morning had prickled with antagonism, mainly Robin's. Now, in the silence, watching the telephone, Some of her anger at Matthew spilled over onto Strike. Where was he? What was he doing? Why was he acting up to Matthew's accusations of irresponsibility? She was here, holding the fort, and he was presumably off chasing his ex-fiancée, and never mind their business. His business. Footsteps on the stairwell. Robin thought she recognised the very slight unevenness in Strike's tread. She waited, glaring towards the stairs, until she was sure that the footfalls were proceeding beyond the first landing. Then she turned her chair resolutely back to face the monitor and began pounding at the keys again, while her heart raced.
Morning.
Hi. She accorded Strike a fleeting glance while continuing to type. He looked tired, unshaven, and unnaturally well-dressed. She was instantly confirmed in her view that he had attempted a reconciliation with Charlotte, by the looks of it, successfully. The next two sentences were pockmarked with typos.
"How are things?" asked Strike,
noting Robin's clenched-jawed profile, her cold demeanour.
"Fine," said Robin.
She now intended to lay her perfectly typed report in front of him, and then, with icy calm, discuss the arrangements for her departure. She might suggest that he hire another temp this week, so that she could instruct her replacement in the day-to-day management of the office before she left. Strike, whose run of appalling luck had been broken in fabulous style just a few hours previously, and who was feeling as close to buoyant as he had been for many months, had been looking forward to seeing his secretary. He had no intention of regaling her with an account of his night's activities, or at least not those that had done so much to restore his battered ego, for he was instinctively close-lipped about such matters, and he was hoping to shore up as much as remained of the boundaries that had been splintered by his copious consumption of Doom Bar. He had, however, been planning an eloquent speech of apology for his excesses of two nights before, an avowal of gratitude and an exposition of all the interesting conclusions he had drawn from yesterday's interviews.
"Fancy a cup of tea?"
"No, thanks."
He looked at his watch.
"I'm only 11 minutes late."
"It's up to you when you arrive. I mean..."
She attempted to backtrack, for her tone had been too obviously hostile.
"It's none of my business what you... when you get here."
From having mentally rehearsed a number of soothing and magnanimous responses to Strike's imagined apologies for his drunken behaviour of 48 hours previously, she now felt that his attitude was distastefully free of shame or remorse. Strike busied himself with kettle and cups, and a few minutes later set down a mug of steaming tea beside her.
"I said I didn't..."
"Could you leave that important document for a minute while I say something to you?"
She saved the report with several thumps of the keys and turned to face him, her arms folded across her chest. Strike sat down on the old sofa.
"I wanted to say sorry about the night before last."
"There's no need," she said, in a small, tight voice.
"Yeah, there is. I can't remember much of what I did. I hope I wasn't obnoxious."
"You weren't."
"You probably got the gist. My ex-fiancée's just got engaged to an old boyfriend. It took her 3 weeks after we split to get another ring on her finger. That's just a figure of speech. I never actually bought her a ring. I never had the money."
Robin gathered from his tone that there had been no reconciliation. But in that case, where had he spent the night? She unfolded her arms and unthinkingly picked up her tea.
"It wasn't your responsibility to come and find me like that. But you probably stopped me collapsing in a gutter or punching someone, so thanks very much."
"No problem," said Robin.
"And thanks for the Alka-Seltzer," said Strike.
"Did it help?"
asked Robin stiffly.
"I nearly puked all over this," said Strike, dealing the sagging sofa a gentle punch with his fist. "But once it kicked in, it helped a lot."
Robin laughed, and Strike remembered, for the first time, the note she had pushed under the door while he slept, and the excuse she had given for her tactful absence.
Right, well, I've been looking forward to hearing how you got on yesterday, he lied. Don't keep me in suspense.
Robin expanded like a water blossom.
I was just typing it up.
Let's have it verbally, and you can put it into the file later, said Strike, with the mental reservation that it would be easy to remove if useless.
Okay, said Robin, both excited and nervous. Well, like I said in my note, I saw that you wanted to look into Professor Agumon and the Malmaison Hotel in Oxford.
Strike nodded, grateful for the reminder, because he had not been able to remember the details of the note, read once in the depths of his blinding hangover.
So, said Robin, a little breathlessly, first of all I went along to Russell Square, to SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies. That's what your notes meant, isn't it? She added. I checked a map. It's walking distance from the British Museum. Isn't that what all those scribbles meant?
Strike nodded again.
Well, I went in there and pretended I was writing a dissertation on African politics, and I wanted some information on Professor Agumon. I ended up speaking to this really helpful secretary in the politics department who'd actually worked for him, and she gave me loads of information on him, including a bibliography and a brief biography. He studied at SOAS as an undergraduate.
He did?
Yes, said Robin, and I got a picture.
From inside the notebook, she pulled out a photocopy and passed it across to Strike. He saw a black man with a long, high cheekbone face, close-cropped greying hair and beard, and gold-rimmed glasses supported by over-large ears. He stared at it for several long moments, and when at last he spoke, he said,
"Christ."
Robin waited, elated.
"Christ," said Strike again.
When did he die?
5 years ago. The secretary got upset talking about it. She said he was so clever, the nicest, kindest man, a committed Christian.
Any family?
Yes. He left a widow and a son.
A son? Repeated Strike.
Yes, said Robin. He's in the army.
In the army, said Strike. Her deep and doleful echo. Don't tell me.
He's in Afghanistan.
Strike got up and started pacing up and down, the picture of Professor Josiah Agumon in his hand.
Didn't get a regiment, did you? Not that it matters, I can find out, he said.
I did ask, said Robin, consulting her notes, but I don't really understand. Is there a regiment called the Sappers or some...
Royal Engineers, said Strike. I can check up on all that.
He stopped beside Robin's desk and stared again at the face of Professor Josiah Agumon.
He was from Ghana originally, she said, but the family lived in Clerkenwell until he died.
Strike handed her back the picture.
Don't lose that. You've done bloody well, Robin.
That's not all, she said, flushed, excited, and trying to keep from smiling. I took the train out to Oxford in the afternoon, to the Malmaison. Do you know, they've made a hotel out of an old prison.
Really?
Said Strike, sinking back onto the sofa.
Yes, it's quite nice, actually. Well, anyway, I thought I'd pretend to be Allison and check whether Tony Landry had left something there or something.
Strike sipped his tea, thinking that it was highly implausible that a secretary would be dispatched in person for such an inquiry 3 months after the event.
Anyway, that was a mistake.
Really? He said, his tone carefully neutral.
Yes, because Allison actually did go to the Malmaison on the 7th to try and find Tony Landry. It was incredibly embarrassing, because one of the girls on reception had been there that day, and she remembered her.
Strike lowered his mug.
Now that, he said, is very interesting indeed.
I know, said Robin excitedly. So then I had to think really fast.
Did you tell them your name was Annabel?
No, she said, on a half laugh. I said, well, okay then, I'll tell the truth, I'm his girlfriend. And I cried a bit.
You cried?
It wasn't actually that hard, said Robin, with an air of surprise. I got right into character.
I said I thought he was having an affair.
Not with Alison. If they've seen her, they wouldn't believe that...
No. But I said I didn't think he'd really been at the hotel at all. Anyway, I made a bit of a scene, and the girl who'd spoken to Alison took me aside and tried to calm me down. She said they couldn't give out information about people without a good reason. They had a policy, blah, blah, you know. But just to stop me crying, in the end, she told me that he had checked in on the evening of the 6th and checked out on the morning of the 8th. He made a fuss about being given the wrong newspaper while he was checking out. That's why she remembered. So he was definitely there. I even asked her a bit, you know, hysterically, how she knew it was him, and she described him to a T. I know what he looks like, she added, before Strike could ask. I checked before I left. His picture's on the Landry May Patterson website.
You're brilliant, said Strike. And this is all bloody fishy. What does she tell you about Alison?
That she arrived and asked to see him, but he wasn't there. They confirmed that he was staying with them, though, and then she left.
Very odd. She should have known he was at the conference. Why didn't she go there first?
I don't know.
Did this helpful hotel employee say she'd seen him at any times other than check-in and check-out?
No, said Robin. But we know he went to the conference, don't we? I checked that, remember?
We know he signed in and probably picked up a name tag. And then he drove back to Chelsea to see his sister, Lady Bristow.
Why? Well, she was ill.
Was she? She'd just had an operation that was supposed to cure her.
A hysterectomy, said Robin. I don't imagine you'd feel wonderful after that.
So we've got a man who doesn't like his sister very much. I've had that from his own lips. Who believes she's just had a life-saving operation and knows she's got two of her children in attendance. Why the urgency to see her?
Well, said Robin with less certainty. I suppose she'd just got out of hospital.
Which he presumably knew was going to happen before he drove off to Oxford. So why not stay in town? Visit her if he felt that strongly about it, and then head out to the afternoon session of the conference. Why drive 50-odd miles, stay overnight in this plush prison, go to the conference, sign in, and then double back to town?
Maybe he got a call saying she was feeling bad, something like that. Maybe John Bristow rang him and asked him to come.
Bristow's never mentioned asking his uncle to drop in. I'd say they were on bad terms at the time. They're both shifty about that visit of Landry's. Neither of them likes talking about it.
Strike stood up and began to walk up and down, limping slightly, barely noticing the pain in his leg.
No, he said. Bristow asking his sister, who by all accounts was the apple of his mother's eye, to drop by, that makes sense. Asking his mother's brother, who was out of town and by no means her biggest fan, to make a massive detour to see her, that doesn't smell right. And now we find out that Alison went looking for Landry at his hotel in Oxford. It was a work day. Was she checking up on him on her own account? Or did someone send her?
The telephone rang. Robin picked up the receiver. To Strike's surprise, she immediately affected a very stilted Australian accent.
I'm sorry, she's not here, no. No, I don't know where she is. No. My name's Annabelle.
Strike laughed quietly. Robin threw him a look of mock anguish. After nearly a minute of strangled Australian, she hung up. Temporary solutions, she said. I'm getting through a lot of Annabelles. That one sounded more South African than Australian. Now, I want to hear what happened to you yesterday, said Robin, unable to conceal her impatience any longer. Did you meet Bryony Radford and Kiara Porter? Strike told her everything that had happened, omitting only the aftermath of his excursion to Evan Duffield's flat. He placed particular emphasis on Bryony Radford's insistence that it was dyslexia that had caused her to listen to Ursula May's voicemail messages, on Kiara Porter's continuing assertion that Lula had told her she would leave everything to her brother, on Evan Duffield's annoyance that Lula had kept checking the time while she was in Uzi, and on the threatening email that Tansy Bastigui had sent her estranged husband.
So where was Tansy? Asked Robin,
who had listened to every word of Strike's story with gratifying attention.
If we can just find out...
Oh, I'm pretty sure I know where she was, said Strike. It's getting her to admit it, when it might blow her chances of a multi-million pound settlement from Freddy. That's going to be the difficult bit. You'll be able to work it out too, if you just look through the police photographs again.
But have a look at the pictures of the front of the building on the morning Lula died, and then think about how it was when we saw it. It'll be good for your detective training.
Robin experienced a great surge of excitement and happiness, immediately tempered by a cold pang of regret because she would soon be leaving for human resources.
I need change, said Strike, standing up. Please will you try Freddy Bastigui again for me?
He disappeared into the inner room, closed the door behind him, and swapped his lucky suit, as he thought he might henceforth call it, for an old and comfortable shirt and a roomier pair of trousers. When he passed Robin's desk on the way to the bathroom, she was on the telephone, wearing that expression of disinterested attentiveness that betokens a person on hold. Strike cleaned his teeth in the cracked basin, reflecting on how much easier life with Robin would be now that he had tacitly admitted that he lived in the office and returned to find her off the telephone and looking exasperated.
"I don't think they're even bothering to take my messages now," she told Strike. "They say he's out at Pinewood Studios and can't be disturbed."
Well, at least we know he's back in the country," said Strike.
He took the interim report out of the filing cabinet, sank back down on the sofa, and began to add his notes of yesterday's conversations in silence. Robin watched out of the corner of her eye, fascinated by the meticulousness with which Strike tabulated his findings, making a precise record of how, where, and from whom he had gained each piece of information.
"I suppose," she asked,
after a long stretch of silence, during which she had divided her time between covert observation of Strike at work and examination of a photograph of the front of No. 18 Kentigern Gardens on Google Earth.
"You have to be very careful in case you forget anything."
"It's not only that," said Strike, still writing and not looking up. "You don't want to give defending counsel any footholds."
He spoke so calmly, so reasonably, that Robin considered the implications of his words for several moments, in case she could have misunderstood.
"You mean, in general?" she said at last. "On principle?"
"No," said Strike, continuing his report. "I mean that I specifically do not want to allow the defending counsel in the trial of the person who killed Lula Landry to get off because he was able to show that I can't keep records properly, thereby calling into question my reliability as a witness."
Strike was showing off again, and he knew it. But he could not help himself. He was, as he put it to himself, on a roll. Some might have questioned the taste of finding amusement in the midst of a murder inquiry, but he had found humour in darker places.
"You couldn't nip out for some sandwiches, Robin, could you?" he added, just so that he could glance up at her satisfyingly astonished expression.
He finished his notes during her absence, and was just about to call an old colleague in Germany, when Robin burst back in, holding two packs of sandwiches and a newspaper.
"Your picture's on the front of the Standard," she panted.
"What?"
It was a photograph of Chiara following Duffield into his flat. Chiara looked stunning. For half a second, Strike was transported back to 2:30 that morning, when she had lain, white and naked, beneath him, that long silky hair spread on the pillow like a mermaid's, as she whispered and moaned. Strike refocused. He was half cropped out of the picture, one arm raised to keep the paparazzi at bay.
"That's all right," he told Robin with a shrug, handing her back the paper. "They think I was the minder."
"It says," said Robin, turning to the inside page, "that she left Duffield's with her security guard at 2:00.
"There you go, then."
Robin stared at him. His account of the night had terminated with himself, Duffield and Chiara at Duffield's flat. She had been so interested in the various pieces of evidence he had laid out before her, she had forgotten to wonder where he had slept. She had assumed that he had left the model and the actor together. He had arrived at the office still wearing the clothes in the photograph. She turned away, reading the story on page 2. The clear implication of the piece was that Chiara and Duffield had enjoyed an amorous encounter while the supposed minder waited in the hall.
"Is she stunning looking in person?" asked Robin,
with an unconvincing casualness as she folded the standard.
"Yeah, she is," said Strike.
And he wondered whether it was his imagination that the three syllables sounded like a boast.
"Do you want cheese and pickle or egg mayonnaise?"
Robin made her selection at random and returned to her desk chair to eat. Her new hypothesis about Strike's overnight whereabouts had eclipsed even her excitement over the progress of the case. It was going to be difficult to reconcile her view of him as a blighted romantic with the fact that he had just, it seemed incredible, and yet she had heard his pathetic attempt to conceal his pride, slept with a supermodel. The telephone rang again. Strike, whose mouth was full of bread and cheese, raised a hand to forestall Robin, swallowed, and answered it himself.
"Cormoran, Strike."
"Strike, it's Wardle."
"Hi, Wardle, how's it going?"
"Not so good, actually. We've just fished a body out of the Thames with your card on it. Wondered what you could tell us about it."
Chapter 10. It was the first taxi that Strike had felt justified in taking since the day he had moved his belongings out of Charlotte's flat. He watched the charges mount with detachment as the cab rolled towards Wapping. The taxi driver was determined to tell him why Gordon Brown was a fucking disgrace. Strike sat in silence for the entire trip. This would not be the first morgue Strike had visited, and far from the first corpse he had viewed. He had become almost immune to the despoliation of gunshot wounds, bodies ripped, torn and shattered, innards revealed like the contents of a butcher's shop, shining and bloody. Strike had never been squeamish. Even the most mutilated corpses, cold and white in their freezer drawers, became sanitized and standardized to a man with his job. It was the bodies he had seen in the raw, unprocessed and unprotected by officialdom and procedure, that rose again and crawled through his dreams. His mother in the funeral parlour, in her favourite floor-length bell-sleeved dress, gaunt yet young, with no needle marks on view. Sergeant Gary Topley, lying in the blood-spattered dust of that Afghanistan road, his face unscathed, but with no body below the upper ribs. As Strike had lain in the hot dirt, he had tried not to look at Gary's empty face, afraid to glance down and see how much of his own body was missing, but he had slid so swiftly into the maw of oblivion that he did not find out until he woke up in the field hospital. An impressionist print hung on the bare brick walls of the small anteroom to the morgue. Strike fixed his gaze on it, wondering where he had seen it before, and finally remembering that it hung over the mantelpiece at Lucy and Greg's.
"Mr. Strike," said the grey-haired mortician, peering around the inner door in white coat and latex gloves. "Come on in."
They were almost always cheerful, pleasant men, these curators of corpses. Strike followed the mortician into the chilly glare of the large, windowless inner room, with its great steel freezer doors all along the right-hand wall. The gently sloping tiled floor ran down to a central drain. The lights were dazzling. Every noise echoed off the hard and shiny surfaces, so that it sounded as though a small group of men was marching into the room. A metal trolley stood ready in front of one of the freezer doors, and beside it were the two CID officers, Wardle and Carver. The former greeted Strike with a nod and a muttered greeting. The latter, paunchy and mottle-faced, with suit shoulders covered in dandruff, merely grunted. The mortician wrenched down the thick metal arm on the freezer door. The tops of three anonymous heads were revealed, stacked one above the other, each draped in a white sheet worn limp and fine through repeated washings.
The mortician checked the tag pinned to the cloth covering the central head. It bore no name, only the previous day's scribbled date. He slid the body out smoothly on its long-runner tray and deposited it efficiently onto the waiting trolley. Strike noticed Carver's jaw working as he stepped back, giving the mortician room to wheel the trolley clear of the freezer door. With a clunk and a slam, the remaining corpses vanished from view.
"We won't bother with a viewing room, seeing as we're the only ones here," said the mortician briskly. "Lights best in the middle," he added, positioning the trolley just beside the drain and pulling back the sheet.
The body of Rochelle Onifade was revealed, bloated and distended, her face forever wiped of suspicion, replaced by a kind of empty wonder. Strike had known, from Wardle's brief description on the telephone, whom he would see when the sheet was revealed. But the awful vulnerability of the dead struck him anew as he looked down on the body, far smaller than it had been when she had sat opposite him, consuming fries and concealing information. Strike told them her name, spelling it so that both the mortician and Wardle could transcribe it accurately onto clipboard and notebook, respectively. He also gave the only address he had ever known for her, St. Elmo's Hostel for the Homeless in Hammersmith.
"Who found her?"
"River police hooked her out late last night," said Carver, speaking for the first time. His voice, with its South London accent, held a definite undertone of animosity. "Bodies usually take about 3 weeks to rise to the surface, eh?" he added, directing the comment, more statement than question, at the mortician, who gave a tiny, cautious cough.
"That is the accepted average, but I wouldn't be surprised if it turns out to be less in this case. There are certain indications."
"Yeah, well, we'll get all that from the pathologist," said Carver dismissively.
"It can't have been 3 weeks," said Strike, and the mortician gave him a tiny smile of solidarity.
"Why not?" demanded Carver. "Because I bought her a burger and chips 2 weeks ago yesterday."
"Ah," said the mortician, nodding at Strike across the body. "I was going to say that a lot of carbohydrates taken prior to death can affect the body's buoyancy. There's a degree of bloating."
"That's when you gave her your card, is it?" Wardle asked Strike.
"Yeah. I'm surprised it was still legible."
"It was stuck in with her Oyster card, in a plastic cover inside her back jeans pocket. The plastic protected it."
"What was she wearing?"
"Big pink fake fur coat, like a skinned muppet, jeans and trainers."
"That's what she was wearing when I bought her the burger."
"In that case, the contents of the stomach should give an accurate..." began the mortician.
"Do you know if she's got any next of kin?" Carver demanded of Strike. "There's an aunt in Kilburn. I don't know her name."
Slivers of glistening eyeballs showed through Rochelle's almost closed lids. They had the characteristic brightness of the drowned. There were traces of bloody foam in the creases around her nostrils.
"How are her hands?" Strike asked the mortician, because Rochelle was uncovered only to the chest.
"Never mind her hands," snapped Carver. "We're done here, thanks," he told the mortician loudly, his voice reverberating around the room. And then to Strike, "We want a word with you. Car's outside."
He was helping police with their inquiries. Strike remembered hearing the phrase on the news when he had been a small boy, obsessed by every aspect of police work. His mother had always blamed this strange early preoccupation on her brother, Ted, ex-redcap and fount of, to Strike, thrilling stories of travel, mystery and adventure. Helping police with their inquiries. As a 5-year-old, Strike had imagined a noble and disinterested citizen volunteering to give up his time and energy to assist the police, who issued him with a magnifying glass and truncheon and allowed him to operate under a cloak of glamorous anonymity. This was the reality. A small interrogation room with a cup of machine-made coffee given to him by Wardle, whose attitude towards Strike
was devoid of the animosity that crackled from Carver's every open pore, but free of every trace of former friendliness. Strike suspected that Wardle's superior did not know the full extent of their previous interactions. A small black tray on the scratch desk held 17 pence in change, a single Yale key, and a plastic-covered bus pass. Strike's card was discoloured and crinkled, but still legible.
"What about her bag?" Strike asked Carver, who was sitting across the desk, while Wardle leaned up against the filing cabinet in the corner.
"Grey, cheap and plastic-looking. That hasn't turned up, has it?"
"She probably left it in her squat, or wherever the fuck she lived," said Carver. "Suicides don't usually pack a bag to jump."
"I don't think she jumped," said Strike.
"Oh, don't you now?"
"I wanted to see her hands. She hated water over her face, she told me so. When people have struggled in the water, the position of their hands..."
"Well, it's nice to get your expert opinion,"
said Carver with sledgehammer irony.
"I know who you are, Mr. Strike."
He leaned back in his chair, placing his hands behind his head, revealing dried patches of sweat on the underarms of his shirt. The sharp, sour, oniony smell of B.O. wafted across the desk.
"He's ex-S.I.B.," threw in Wardle, from beside the filing cabinet.
"I know that," barked Carver, raising wiry eyebrows flecked with scurf.
"I've heard from Anstice all about the fucking leg and the life-saving medal. Quite the colourful CV."
Carver removed his hands from behind his head, leaned forwards, and laced his fingers together on the desk instead. His corned beef complexion and the purple bags under his hard eyes were not flattered by the strip lighting.
"I know who your old man is and all."
Strike scratched his unshaven chin, waiting.
"Like to be as rich and famous as Daddy, would ya? Is that what all this is about?"
Carver had the bright blue, bloodshot eyes that Strike had always, since meeting a major in the Paras with just such eyes, who was subsequently cashiered for serious bodily harm, associated with a choleric, violent nature.
"Rochelle didn't jump, nor did Lula Landry."
"Bollocks!" shouted Carver.
"You're speaking to the two men who prove Landry jumped. We went through every bit of fucking evidence with a fine-tooth fucking comb. I know what you're up to. You're milking that poor sod Bristow for all you can get. Why are you fucking smiling at me?"
"I'm thinking what a tit you're going to look when this interview gets reported in the press."
"Don't you dare fucking threaten me with the press, dickhead."
Carver's blunt, white face was clenched, his glaring blue eyes vivid in the purple-red face.
"You're in a heap of trouble here, pal, and a famous dad, a peg leg, and a good war aren't going to get you out of it. How do we know you didn't scare the poor bitch into fucking jumping? Mentally ill, wasn't she? How do we know you didn't make her think she'd done something wrong? You were the last person to see her alive, pal. I wouldn't like to be sitting where you are now."
"Rochelle crossed Grantley Road and walked away from me, as alive as you are.
You'll find someone who saw her after she left me. Nobody's going to forget that coat."
Wardle pushed himself off the filing cabinets, dragged a hard plastic chair over to the desk and sat down.
"Let's have it then," he told Strike. "Your theory?"
"She was blackmailing Lula Landry's killer."
"Piss off," snapped Carver,
and Wardle snorted in slightly stagey amusement.
"The day before she died," said Strike, "Landry met Rochelle for 15 minutes in that shop, Vashti.
She dragged Rochelle straight into a changing cubicle, where she made a telephone call begging somebody to meet her at her flat in the early hours of the following morning. That call was overheard by an assistant at the shop. She was in the next cubicle. They're separated by a curtain. Girl called Mel. Red hair and tattoos."
"People will spare any amount of shit when there's a celebrity involved," said Carver.
"If Landry phoned anyone from that cubicle," said Wardle, "it was Duffield or her uncle. Her phone records show that they were the only people she called all afternoon."
Why did she want Rochelle there when she made the call? Asked Strike. Why drag her friend into the cubicle with her?
Women do that stuff, said Carver. They piss in herds too. Use your fucking intelligence.
She was making the call on Rochelle's phone, said Strike, exasperated. She tested everyone she knew to try and see who was talking to the press about her. Rochelle was the only one who kept her mouth shut. She established that the girl was trustworthy, bought her a mobile, registered it in Rochelle's name, but took care of all the charges. She'd had her own phone hacked, hadn't she? She was getting paranoid about people listening in and reporting on her, so she bought a Nokia and registered it to somebody else to give herself a totally secure means of communication when she wanted it. I grant you, that doesn't necessarily rule out her uncle or Duffield, because calling them on the alternative number might have been a signal they'd organised between them. Alternatively, she was using Rochelle's number to speak to somebody else, someone she didn't want the press to know about. I've got Rochelle's mobile number. Find out what network she was with, and you'll be able to check all this. The unit itself is a crystal-covered pink Nokia, but you won't find that.
Yeah, because it's at the bottom of the Thames, said Wardle.
Course it isn't, said Strike. The killer's got it. He'll have got it off her before he threw her into the river.
Fuck off, jeered Carver,
and Wardle, who had seemed interested against his better judgment, shook his head.
Why did Landry want Rochelle there when she made the call? Strike repeated. Why not make it from the car? Why, when Rochelle was homeless and virtually destitute, did she never sell her story on Landry? They'd have given her a great wad for it. Why didn't she cash in once Landry was dead and couldn't be hurt?
Decency, suggested Wardle.
Yeah, that's one possibility, said Strike. The other is that she was making enough by blackmailing the killer.
Bollocks, moaned Carver.
Yeah? That Muppet coat she was pulled up wearing cost 1.5 grand.
A tiny pause.
Landry probably gave it to her, said Wardle. If she did, she managed to buy her something that wasn't in the shops back in January.
Landry was a model she had inside contacts. Fuck this shit, snapped Carver, as though he had irritated himself.
Why?
Said Strike, leaning forwards on his arms into the miasma of body odour that surrounded Carver. Did Lula Landry make a detour to that shop for 15 minutes?
She was in a hurry.
Why go at all?
She didn't want to let the girl down.
She got Rochelle to come right across town, this penniless homeless girl, the girl she usually gave a lift home afterwards in her chauffeur-driven car, dragged her into a cubicle and then walked out 15 minutes later, leaving her to make her own way home.
She was a spoilt bitch.
If she was, why turn up at all?
Because it was worth it, for some purpose of her own.
And if she wasn't a spoiled bitch, she must have been in some kind of emotional state that made her act out of character. There's a living witness to the fact that Lula begged somebody, over the phone, to come and see her, at her flat, sometime after 1 in the morning. There's also that piece of blue paper she had before she went into Vashti, and which nobody's admitting to having seen since. What did she do with it? Why was she writing in the back of the car before she saw Rochelle?
It could have been, said Wardle.
It wasn't a fucking shopping list, groaned Strike, thumping the desk. And nobody writes a suicide note 8 hours in advance and then goes dancing. She was writing a bloody will. Don't you get it? She took it into Vashti to get Rochelle to witness it.
Bollocks, said Carver yet again.
But Strike ignored him, addressing Wardle.
Which fits with her telling Kiara Porter that she was going to leave everything to her brother, doesn't it? She just made it legal. It was on her mind.
Why suddenly make a will?
Strike hesitated and sat back. Carver leered at him.
Imagination run out.
Strike let out his breath in a long sigh. An uncomfortable night of alcohol-sodden unconsciousness. Last night's pleasurable excesses, half a cheese and pickle sandwich in 12 hours. He felt hollowed out, exhausted.
If I had hard evidence, I'd have brought it to you. The odds of people close to a suicide killing themselves go right up. Did you know that? This Raquel was a depressive. She has a bad day, remembers the way out her mate took, and does a copycat jump. Which leads us right back to you, pal. Persecuting people and pushing them over the edge. Yeah, said Strike. People keep saying that. Very poor fucking taste in the circumstances. What about Tansy Bastigui's evidence? How many times, Strike? We proved she couldn't have heard it, Wardle said. We proved it beyond doubt.
No, you didn't, said Strike, finally, when he least expected it, losing his temper. You based your whole case on one almighty fuck-up. If you'd taken Tansy Bastigui seriously, if you'd broken her down and got her to tell you the whole fucking truth, Rochelle Onifade would still be alive.
Pulsating with rage, Carver kept Strike there for another hour. His last act of contempt was to tell Wardle to make sure he saw Rokeby Jr. firmly off the premises. Wardle walked Strike to the front door, not speaking.
I need you to do something, said Strike, halting at the exit, beyond which they could see the darkening sky. You've had enough from me already, mate, said Wardle, with a wry smile. I'm going to be dealing with that, he jerked his thumb over his shoulder towards Carver and his temper, for days because of you. I told you it was suicide.
Wardle, unless someone brings the fucker in, there are two more people in danger of being knocked off.
Strike, what if I bring you proof that Tansy Bastigui wasn't in her flat at all when Lula fell? That she was somewhere she could have heard everything?
Wardle looked up towards the ceiling and closed his eyes momentarily.
If you've got proof, I haven't. But I will have in the next couple of days.
Two men walked past them, talking, laughing. Wardle shook his head, looking exasperated, and yet he did not turn away.
If you want something from the police, call Anstis. He's the one who owes you. Anstis can't do this for me. I need you to call D.B. Mack.
What the fuck?
You heard me. He's not going to take my calls, is he? But he'll speak to you. You've got the authority. And it sounds as though he likes you.
You're telling me D.B. Mack knows where Tansy Bastigui was when Lula Landry died?
No, of course he bloody doesn't. He was in Barrack. I want to know what clothes he got sent on from Kentigern Gardens to Claridge's. Specifically, what stuff he got from Guy Sommet.
Strike did not pronounce the name Guy for Wardle.
You want...
Why?
Because one of the runners on that CCTV footage was wearing one of DB's sweatshirts.
Wardle's expression, arrested for a moment, relapsed into exasperation.
You see that stuff everywhere,
he said after a moment or two. That GS stuff, shell suits, trackies.
This was a customised hoodie. There was only one of them in the world.
Call DB and ask him what he got from Sommet. That's all I need.
Whose side do you want to be on if it turns out I'm right, Wardle?
Don't threaten me, Strike.
I'm not threatening you. I'm thinking about a multiple murderer who's walking around out there planning the next one. But if it's the papers you're worried about, I don't think they're going to go too easy on anyone who clung to the suicide theory once another body surfaced. Call DB Mack, Wardle, before someone else gets killed.
Chapter 11.
No, said Strike forcefully, on the telephone that evening. This is getting dangerous. Surveillance doesn't fall within the scope of secretarial duties.
Nor did visiting the Malmaison Hotel in Oxford, or SOAS, Robin pointed out. But you were happy enough that I did both of them.
You're not following anyone, Robin. I doubt Matthew would be very happy about it either.
It was funny, Robin thought, sitting in her dressing gown on her bed, with the phone pressed to her ear, how Strike had retained the name of her fiancé without ever having met him. In her experience, men did not usually bother to log that kind of information.
Matthew frequently forgot people's names, even that of his newborn niece, but she supposed that Strike must have been trained to recall such details. "I don't need Matthew's permission," she said. "Anyway, it wouldn't be dangerous. You don't think Ursula Mays killed anyone?" There was an inaudible, "Do you?" at the end of the sentence. "No, but I don't want anyone to hear I'm taking an interest in her movements. It might make the killer nervous, and I don't want anyone else thrown from a height." Robin could hear her own heart thumping through the thin material of her dressing gown. She knew that he would not tell her who he thought the killer was. She was even a little frightened of knowing, notwithstanding the fact that she could think of nothing else. It was she who had called Strike. Hours had passed since she had received a text saying that he had been compelled to go with the police to Scotland Yard and asking her to lock up the office behind her at 5. Robin had been worried.
"Call him, then, if he's going to keep you awake," Matthew had said, not quite snapping, not quite indicating that he was, without knowing any of the details, firmly on the side of the police.
"Listen, I want you to do something for me," said Strike. "Call John Bristow first thing tomorrow and tell him about Rochelle."
"All right," said Robin. With her eyes on the large stuffed elephant Matthew had given her on their first Valentine's Day together 8 years previously. The present giver himself was watching Newsnight in the sitting room.
"What are you going to be doing?"
"I'm going to be on my way to Pinewood Studios for a few words with Freddie Bastigui."
"How?" said Robin. "They won't let you near him."
"Yeah, they will," said Strike.
After Robin had hung up, Strike sat motionless for a while in his dark office. The thought of the semi-digested McDonald's meal lying inside Rochelle's bloated corpse had not prevented him consuming 2 Big Macs, a large box of fries, and a McFlurry on the way back from Scotland Yard. Gassy noises from his stomach were now mingling with the muffled thuds of the bass from the 12-bar cafe, which Strike barely noticed these days. The sound might have been his own pulse. Kiara Porter's messy, girlish flat, her wide, groaning mouth, the long white legs wrapped tightly around his back, belonged to a life lived long ago. All his thoughts now were for squat and graceless Rochelle Onifade. He remembered her talking fast into her phone, not 5 minutes after she had left him, dressed in exactly the same clothes she had been wearing when they pulled her out of the river. He was sure he knew what had happened. Rochelle had called the killer to say that she had just lunched with a private detective. A meeting had been arranged over her glittering pink phone. That night, after a meal or a drink, they had sauntered through the dark towards the river. He thought of Hammersmith Bridge, sage green and gold, in the area where she claimed to have a new flat. A famous suicide spot, with its low sides and the fast-flowing Thames below. She could not swim. Nighttime. Two lovers play-fighting, a car sweeps by, a scream and a splash. Would anyone have seen? Not if the killer had ironclad nerves and a liberal dash of luck. And this was a murderer who had already demonstrated plenty of the former and an unnerving, reckless reliance on the latter. Defending counsel would undoubtedly argue diminished responsibility because of the vainglorious overreaching that made Strike's quarry unique in his experience. And perhaps, he thought, there was some pathology there, some categorizable madness, but he was not much interested in the psychology. Like John Bristow, he wanted justice. In the darkness of his office, his thoughts veered suddenly and unhelpfully back in time to the most personal death of all. The one that Lucy assumed, quite wrongly, haunted Strike's every investigation, coloured every case. The killing that had fractured his and Lucy's lives into 2 epochs, so that everything in their memory was cleaved clearly into what had happened before their mother died and that which had happened afterwards. Lucy thought he had run away to join the RMP because of Leader's death, that he had been driven to it by his unsatisfied belief in his stepfather's guilt,
that every corpse he saw in the course of his professional life must recall their mother to his mind, that every killer he met must seem to be an echo of their stepfather, that he was driven to investigate other deaths in an eternal act of personal exculpation. But Strike had aspired to this career long before the last needle had entered Leader's body, long before he had understood that his mother and every other human was mortal, and that killings were more than puzzles to be solved. It was Lucy who never forgot, who lived in a swarm of memories like coffin flies, who projected onto any and all unnatural deaths the conflicting emotions aroused in her by their mother's untimely demise. Tonight, however, he found himself doing the very thing that Lucy was sure must be habitual. He was remembering Leader and connecting her to this case. Leader Strike, super groupie. It was how they always captioned her in the most famous photograph of all, and the only one that featured his parents together. There she was, in black and white, with her heart-shaped face, her shining dark hair, and her marmoset eyes. And there, separated from each other by an art dealer, an aristocratic playboy, one since dead by his own hand, the other of AIDS, and Carla Astolfi, his father's second wife, was Johnny Rokeby himself, androgynous and wild, hair nearly as long as Leader's, martini glasses and cigarettes, smoke curling out of the model's mouth, but his mother more stylish than any of them. Everyone but Strike had seemed to view Leader's death as the deplorable but unsurprising result of a life lived perilously beyond societal norms. Even those who had known her best and longest were satisfied that she herself had administered the overdose they found in her body. His mother, by almost unanimous consent, had walked too close to the unsavoury edges of life, and it was only to be expected that she would one day topple out of sight and fall to her death, stiff and cold, on a filthy sheeted bed. Why she had done it, nobody could quite explain. Not even Uncle Ted, silent and shattered, leaning against the kitchen sink, or Aunt Joan, red-eyed but angry at her little kitchen table, with her arms around 19-year-old Lucy, who was sobbing into Joan's shoulder. An overdose had simply seemed consistent with the trend of Leader's life, with the squats and the musicians and the wild parties, with the squalor of her final relationship and home, with the constant presence of drugs in her vicinity, with her reckless quest for thrills and highs. Strike alone had asked whether anyone had known his mother had taken to shooting up. He alone had seen a distinction between her predilection for cannabis and a sudden liking for heroin. He alone had unanswered questions and saw suspicious circumstances. But he had been a student of 20, and nobody had listened. After the trial and the conviction, Strike had packed up and left everything behind. The short-lived burst of press, Aunt Joan's desperate disappointment at the end of his Oxford career, Charlotte, bereft and incensed by his disappearance and already sleeping with someone new, Lucy's screams and scenes. With the sole support of Uncle Ted, he had vanished into the army and refound there the life he had been taught by Leader, constant uprootings, self-reliance, and the endless appeal of the new. Tonight, though, he could not help seeing his mother as a spiritual sister to the beautiful, needy, and depressive girl who had broken apart on a frozen road, and to the plain, homeless outsider now lying in the chilly morgue. Leader, Lula, and Rochelle had not been women like Lucy or his Aunt Joan. They had not taken every reasonable precaution against violence or chance. They had not tethered themselves to life with mortgages and voluntary work, safe husbands and clean-faced dependents. Their deaths, therefore, were not classed as tragic in the same way as those of staid and respectable housewives. How easy it was to capitalize on a person's own bent for self-destruction. How simple to nudge them into non-being, then to stand back and shrug and agree that it had been the inevitable result of a chaotic, catastrophic life. Nearly all the physical evidence of Lula's murder had long since been wiped away. trodden underfoot or covered by thickly falling snow. The most persuasive clue Strike had was, after all, that grainy black-and-white footage of two men running away from the scene. A piece of evidence given a cursory check and tossed aside by the police, who were convinced that nobody could have entered the building, that Landry had committed suicide, and that the film showed nothing more than a pair of larcenous loiterers with intent. Strike roused himself and looked at his watch. It was 10:30, but he was sure the man to whom he wished to speak would be awake. He flicked on his desk lamp, took up his mobile and dialed, this time a number in Germany.
"Oggy!" bellowed the tinny voice on the other end of the phone. "How the fuck are you? Need a favour, mate?"
And Strike asked Lieutenant Graham Hardacre to give him all the information he could find on one Aguman of the Royal Engineers, Christian name and rank unknown, but with particular reference to the dates of his tours of duty in Afghanistan.